The legacy of this incredible game weighed heavily on the team and impacted so many of the decisions. Where BioWare's Dragon Age Inquisition team was bedeviled by negative reactions to Dragon Age 2, see Chapter 6, Blizzard had the opposite problem. Diablo 3 had to surpass Diablo 2's massive success. The designers of Diablo 3 had been willing to make big innovations in some areas, like the flexible skill system, generally considered a highlight of the game, but in Mascara's view, they were too rigid about other series traditions. As a newcomer, Mascara was willing to challenge everyone's conceptions of what made Diablo feel like Diablo, even if it meant picking fights with some of Blizzard's veterans. For the console version, which was still in development alongside Reaper of Souls, Mascara had fought hard for an evade feature that would allow players to use a joystick to roll around on the ground, dodging enemies' attacks. This was controversial. Evade was extremely contentious on the team, Mascara said. Extremely, extremely contentious. I would get into very heated discussions with some of the other designers about why we needed it on console. Mascara argued that players would get bored walking around for hours at a time without having some method of switching up their movement, like the beloved jump button in World of Warcraft. Other designers pointed out that offering an evade feature would diminish the impact of items that boosted players' movement speed, a concept from Diablo 2, therefore making the game less rewarding in the long term. Both are really strong arguments, said Mascara. Both are right arguments. At the end of the day, you have to say, okay, I'm willing to sacrifice some of that long-term reward for the short-term visceral feeling. I understand I'm giving away the power reward, but for this to feel like a console game, my thumbs need to do something at regular intervals, and it just feels good. It's a console thing to do. Mascara eventually won this battle, and the evade feature made it into the game. By experimenting on consoles where there was less pressure to adhere to the formula of Diablo 2, Mascara and his team could take steps that seemed radical to the rest of the team. I think that was one of the most liberating things, he said. The PC team, for all the right intentions, because of all the pressure, the expectation, some of their initial design was very conservative. But on console, it was a bit of the Wild West. And in some ways, looking back at it, there's a level of being very naive. We've been mucking around with this game for about 6 months, not knowing all the history behind all the decisions leading up to this moment, just walking in like kids and pushing buttons. For a game that had been in development for so many years, a fresh perspective could be useful, especially when Blizzard began re-examining core parts of Diablo 3, like the loot system. In the PC version of Diablo 3, enemies would spawn fountains of loot when they died, offering that familiar dopamine rush for players as they picked up cool new weapons and accessories. But without a mouse and keyboard, sorting through all those glittering rings and amulets could be a chore. As the Diablo 3 console team playtested the game, Mascara found that this loot overload was impeding people's progress, forcing them to stop every few seconds just to organize their inventories. That's when they tweaked the formula. We said, okay, every time a gray or a white item's going to drop, 70% of the time, it's going to just drop gold, said Mascara. The change might have seemed drastic to Diablo 2 devotees, but it wound up forming the foundation for what the team called Loot 2.0, a system that would improve Diablo 3 on both PC and consoles. We started realizing that maybe we can be dropping less, said Mascara. And if you're dropping less, well, we need to drop better. With Loot 2.0, Mascara and his team hoped to address every criticism players had about gear in Diablo 3. Fans complained that it took way too long to get the top-tier legendary items, so Loot 2.0 guaranteed that each major boss would drop legendary gear. Fans pointed out that when they did finally get legendary items, the game would generate those item stats randomly, making it likely that a player would spot a shiny orange weapon and get excited, only to find that the weapon was useless for his class. Randomly generated items didn't quite mesh with Diablo 3's stat system. Whereas in Diablo 2, every stat was useful to every character, no matter what class you played, Diablo 3 took a more focused approach. In Diablo 3, an axe of strength would be useful only to a barbarian, so it'd really suck to get one if you were playing a demon hunter. And an arrow quiver that boosted intelligence, the primary stat for wizards, was useless to just about everyone. Wizards couldn't use arrows. So Loot 2.0 introduced a weighting system, skewing the random number generator to increase the chances that when a player picked up a legendary item, it would be something they needed. As Blizzard's developers met through 2013 to talk about what they wanted to do with Reaper of Souls, randomness became a driving conversation topic. After all, random numbers had always been the pulsing heart of Diablo. Since the first game in 1996, which sent players battling through procedurally generated dungeons under the decrepit city of Tristram, Diablo games had relied on a random number generator for just about everything. Dungeon layouts were random. Treasure chests were random. Most magical items were random, too. The game would piece them together from a large table of prefixes and suffixes with each item's attributes tied to its name. A lucky belt would boost the amount of gold you received from monsters. A sword of the leech would offer health every time you attacked. This randomness was what gave Diablo its mass appeal. Playing a Diablo game was sort of like campaigning in Dungeons & Dragons. Every time you played, you'd have a different experience. There was something naturally addicting about finding a new item and hitting identify, knowing you could wind up with pretty much anything. Diablo appealed to that same instinct that makes us want to feed all our cash into slot machines and lottery tickets. It would have fit in nicely next to the craps tables at a sparkly Vegas casino. It took a long time before the designers realized that their obsession with random numbers was hurting Diablo 3. "I started to worship at the throne of randomness," said Kevin Martins, a lead designer. "And when I could make something more random, I would, missing the point that randomness is a tool to get replayability. When people ask me, what's the major difference between Reaper of Souls and Diablo 3, my shortest possible answer is, we shaved the rough edges off randomness. We made randomness work for the player instead of against them." That was where Diablo 3 diverged from Las Vegas. Blizzard didn't want the house to always win. Josh Mascara and his team realized that the way to keep players happy was to give them the edge. "When Diablo 3 shipped, whether you got a legendary item or not was just a whole bunch of die rolls," said Mascara. "Sometimes you get lucky, sometimes you wouldn't get lucky. In Reaper, we just said, okay, we don't want to cheat. We don't want the player to feel that we're making it easier for them or anything like that, but we just need to raise the floor so it doesn't take me 104 hours to find a legendary." One of Mascara's favorite anecdotes was that when he played Diablo 3 for the first time as an axe-wielding barbarian, it did take him 104 hours to find a legendary item. He checked. When he finally saw that shiny orange item hit the floor, he was elated, until he saw that it was an arrow quiver. Barbarians couldn't use arrows. They also needed to do something about the difficulty. Back when they developed the original version of Diablo 3, Blizzard's designers had believed that players wanted a game more challenging than any Diablo before it. "We have this video, Diablo's going to brutalize you," said Martins. "We had people on our team talking about how hard it was and how even though they're experienced developers, they still get murdered." The truth is, now we're on Hindsight Mountain looking back, that some people want it really hard and some people want a little bit easier, and everything in between. It wasn't just that Inferno mode was too tough. Players had lost their appetite for playing through the same campaign multiple times, with nothing changing but monster strength. The structure that had felt rewarding in 2001 was, for several reasons, a slog in 2012. Video game design had made drastic leaps in the past decade. Dozens of Diablo clones had emerged over the years, and some of them had even improved Diablo 2's structure, though none were quite as successful. When Diablo 3 came out, people expected a less repetitive rhythm. Reaper of Souls was the opportunity to solve these problems. Blizzard's short-term solution for Diablo 3 had been to make Inferno mode less challenging via post-game patches, but with Reaper, they could take things further. "It was probably late November of 2012 when I started to think maybe we should completely redo the difficulty system," said Martins. "That was a tough prospect, though. The whole game is built for these four difficulties. Every monster has their numbers tuned for each of these four difficulties." Kevin Martin zoomed out. What if, instead of treating difficulty levels as stages, the Blizzard team overhauled Diablo 3's structure entirely, making it so monsters would scale with the player's power over the course of the game? And then what if they added a new modifier system, so that anyone who wanted more of a challenge could switch to hard or expert modes to boost enemies' health and damage? If you wanted to make things a little easier, you could simply flip back to normal. To solve Inferno Mode's chicken and egg problem, Blizzard would kill both the chickens and the eggs. To an outside observer, this might have seemed like an obvious method. Most other games use difficulty modes this way, but for a Diablo game, it was revolutionary. "Initially, it seemed like this impossible mountain to climb," Martin said. "You knew you needed to change this major thing, but you never thought about the game in that terms, in automatic difficulty before. We'd never considered it in that manner." They'd never considered it because of Diablo 2. It had never occurred to the team that they should change the difficulty structure because that was just always how Diablo games had done things. Playing through the game on normal, then again on nightmare, and then a third time on hell was part of what made Diablo Diablo, wasn't it? Blizzard had taken flak during Diablo 3's early development just for the minor act of making health orbs drop from enemies, which some fans saw as breaking series tradition, so it had been tough to even think about a move as drastic as upending Diablo's entire structure. But what if they did? And what if they found a better replacement for it? In the months after launch, several Diablo 3 players had complained about not being able to teleport back and forth between the game's four acts, and Blizzard had been looking to find a way to address that feedback. "We worked with the engineers and they said, 'Oh yeah, we can figure out a way to do that,' said Rob Foote. And actually, I think it was an engineer who said, 'But couldn't we do something better?'" Again, they all went into brainstorming mode. What if, instead of solely letting players teleport between areas, Diablo 3 gave them a whole new mode that changed everything? And what if that mode became the focal point for Diablo 3's new endgame? They would call this new feature Adventure Mode. Once you'd finished Reaper of Souls, you could open up this new Adventure Mode and jump into any area of the game, from the deserts of Chaldeum to the frozen peaks of Ariat. Each of the game's five acts would give you a series of randomized bounties like kill a boss or clear a dungeon, and the more bounties you completed, the more loot you'd snag. Adventure Mode would also add special events in what the game called Nephilim Rifts, multi-tiered dungeons that shuffled areas and monsters from all throughout Diablo 3 like some sort of gothic mixtape. As Blizzard envisioned it, Adventure Mode would entertain players for hours and hours once they'd finished the game. It sure beat smashing pottery. In August 2013, at the Gamescom trade show in Germany, Blizzard prepared to announce Reaper of Souls to a packed room full of reporters and fans. This expansion would center on the demonic archangel Malphail. It would come with a new class, the Crusader. And it would introduce all sorts of features, starting with Loot 2.0, in a free patch that Blizzard hoped would signal that the developers of Diablo 3 were listening to the complaints. "Right before we were going to do the announcement, the energy in the room was tense," said Josh Mascara. "I could feel that everybody was thinking, this better be good." You could feel that they almost were expecting to be disappointed. Then Blizzard put on the announcement video, a 4-minute opening cinematic for Reaper of Souls, introducing the world to Malphail. Holding a nasty scythe in each hand, the Archangel sliced his way through a group of Horadra mages and attacked his former brother, the Angel Tyriel. "The Nephilim will stop you," Tyriel said. Responded Malphail, "No one can stop death." Gamescom's audience erupted in applause. "It's almost like this wave of excitement," said Mascara. "You could feel it." I said, "Okay, I think people are willing to give us another chance. Let's not fuck it up." Originally, Blizzard had planned to put out Reaper of Souls later in 2013, but the Diablo 3 team realized they needed more time, delaying it to the first quarter of 2014. This was a surprise to just about nobody. Blizzard had a reputation for taking its sweet time with games. Diablo 3 had taken 10 years after all, and you'd be hard-pressed to find a Blizzard game that hadn't missed at least one deadline. One quote delivered by the director of StarCraft II, Dustin Browder, has always stuck out as a telling description of how Blizzard makes video games. In June 2012, over a year after Blizzard had hoped to ship StarCraft II's first expansion, Heart of the Swarm, Browder spoke to me about the game's progress. "We are 99% done," he said, "but that last 1%'s a bitch." Heart of the Swarm wouldn't come out until March 2013. That last 1% took nearly a year. "The thing that makes scheduling challenging is iteration," said Rob Foote. "You have to allow for iteration if you want to make a great product. Iteration time was the last 1%. Blizzard's producers tried to leave blank slates at the end of their schedules so that their development teams could push, tug, and polish every aspect of their game until they felt like they had something perfect. "And it's challenging too," said Foote, "because people say, 'What's in that? It's a lot of time. What are they actually doing?'" "They're iterating. We don't know what they're going to do, but they're going to be doing something." Even with the extra time for Reaper of Souls, Josh Mascara and his crew had to cut some features. In conjunction with Adventure Mode, the Diablo 3 team had devised a system called Devil's Hand that would place 52 high-powered enemies throughout the game's world. Players would be able to kill them all for collectible items in hopes of eventually getting all 52. The Diablo 3 team didn't have enough time to get Devil's Hand's collection system in shape, though, so Mascara decided to cut it. "We figured we have extra time, but we can't get both of these right," he said. and the really important one is Adventure Mode, because that really changes the way people play the game. So we had to put Devil's Hand off to the side. Ideas from Devil's Hand would later reemerge in Kanai's Cube, a versatile magic box that would, among other things, let Diablo III players absorb and collect powers from their legendary gear. As the months went by, everyone at Blizzard felt ecstatic about the progress they were making. Since Era 37, they changed Diablo III's formula, overhauled the loot system, and thought they could win back millions of players with Reaper of Souls. But Mascara still felt like the game had a critical flaw that they had yet to address, something that seemed at odds with how they wanted people to play the game, the auction house. When Blizzard first announced Diablo III's real money auction house, cynics saw it as a cash grab. After all, Blizzard got to take a healthy cut every time a player sold an item. Blizzard's developers argued that they had more noble motives, insisting that they built the auction house to improve the experience of trading items for players. Back in 2002, Diablo II: Lord of Destruction had become infested with third-party gray markets, in which people would trade real money for powerful items on sketchy, insecure websites. Blizzard's goal was, as Kevin Martins put it, to provide a world-class experience for those players, one that was safe and secure. Not long after Diablo III's launch, however, it became apparent to Blizzard that the auction house was hurting the game. Some players enjoyed trading, sure, especially the ones who were farming loot and selling it for a healthy profit, but for many, the auction house made Diablo III a significantly worse experience. It reduced the thrill of hunting for gear. What was the fun in getting a great roll on a cool new piece of armor if you could just hop on the market and buy a better one? One group of players, who called themselves the Ironborn, after Game of Thrones' House Greyjoy, made a point of refusing to use the auction house. They even sent petitions to Blizzard asking if the developers would consider adding an Ironborn mode to Diablo III. This was a community of players who were saying, "Hey guys, Diablo III is the exact same game, but I'm having this whole new experience choosing to play it without the auction house," said Wyatt Cheng. "You can look at Diablo through that lens and say, you know what, we've got this really amazing game, but the auction house is having this distorting effect on how some people might perceive it." One day in September 2013, as Reaper of Souls was in full production, Josh Mascara sat in a meeting, doodling in a notebook. It was one of Blizzard's routine monthly strategy meetings, at which CEO Mike Morhaime would get together with company executives and project leads to talk about the business, and much of the technical finance talk was bouncing off Mascara. Then the conversation turned to Diablo III, and suddenly they were talking about the auction house. Mike said, "Well, what do you think?" said Mascara. "If I was anywhere else, I probably would have said, you know what, I think we still need to figure things out, or I'm not quite sure. But looking at those guys and knowing how important having our players have faith in us was, I said, you know what, guys, maybe we should just kill it." After some brief discussions about how the logistics might work, how would they communicate it to players, what would they do with current auctions, how long would they need to wait, the decision crystallized. It was time for Diablo III's auction house to die. "I was thinking, wow, this is happening," said Mascara. "I think to Mike's credit, Mike's a huge gamer. He loves the games. He loves players more than anything else. And he's just willing to make those decisions and say, you know, this is going to hurt. But it's the right thing to do." On September 17th, 2013, Blizzard announced that it would shut down the auction house in March 2014. Fans were, for the most part, thrilled by the news. Now you'd be able to go hunt for loot in Diablo III without the nagging feeling that you could just pay money for something better. Wrote one Kotaku commenter, "Good job, Blizzard. You've actually restored some faith in me. I may actually play this again." Diablo is best experienced when, as a result of slaying monsters, you get better items that allow you to make your character more powerful, said Wyatt Cheng. "And if the activity that I do to make my character more powerful does not include killing monsters, then that's not a good place to be." Now it felt like they'd found the perfect formula for Reaper of Souls. In addition to the new area, Westmarch, and boss, Malphail, the expansion would come with Loot 2.0, free to all players via patch, Adventure Mode, and an overhauled difficulty system. The week before Reaper of Souls released, Blizzard would remove the auction house. As they finalized the development of the expansion and prepared for launch, Mascara and his team felt like this was the big moment. They were going to win people back. When Reaper of Souls launched on March 25th, 2014, there was no Error 37. Blizzard had bolstered its infrastructure this time around. Plus, the company had decided to improve the error messaging system so that even if something went awry, the warning wouldn't be so vague. I think one of the other lessons that we learned is, If you were there, anxious, and you logged in and you got error 37, you thought, "What is error 37? I have no idea what this is," said Josh Mascara. Now all the error messages are more descriptive. They say, "This is the problem we're having. Here's a time frame where you can expect this problem to be fixed." As they watched the reactions pour in, Blizzard staff collectively breathed a sigh of relief. So did Diablo players. "Diablo 3 has finally rediscovered the moment-to-moment gameplay that made the series great," wrote a reviewer for Ars Technica, "and fixed or removed almost everything that got in the way of that greatness. Reaper of Souls is the redemption of Diablo 3." 2 years after launch, people were finally falling in love with Diablo 3. When you went to the forums or when you started getting feedback directly from fans, the issues they were complaining about were more specific and less broad, said Kevin Martins. "That was when I really thought, okay, we're finally getting there." As Martins and other designers browsed through Reddit or Battle.net, they were encouraged to see players complaining about underpowered items or asking Blizzard to buff specific builds. No longer were people offering the three words of feedback that serve as a death warrant for any game: "This isn't fun." What was most gratifying for Josh Mascara was that people especially loved the console version of Diablo 3, which launched on PS3 and Xbox 360 in September 2013, and on the newer consoles, PS4 and Xbox One, in August 2014. After decades of clicking, many gamers almost felt sacrilegious saying so, but playing Diablo 3 was more fun with a PlayStation 4 controller than it ever had been with a mouse and keyboard. In the coming months and years, Blizzard would go on to release more patches and features for Diablo 3. Some were free, like a dungeon called Grey Hollow Island and a revamped version of the cathedral from the first Diablo game. Others cost money, like the Necromancer character class. Although fans lamented the absence of another big expansion pack, which as of early 2017 hadn't happened, it was clear that Blizzard had committed to supporting Diablo 3 for years after its release. Other developers might not have bothered, especially after the launch day catastrophe. Mike Morheim, the president of the company, said to us, "We want to win and earn the love and trust of our players," said Wyatt Cheng. "We had all this work we had done in this game. We believed in the game. We knew it was great. And it would have been so tragic, I think, if we were at a company that said, 'Oh, error 37, pull the plug.'" Josh Mascara, on the other hand, was done with Diablo 3. In the summer of 2016, Mascara left Blizzard, joining Rob Pardo, a veteran Blizzard executive and the lead designer of World of Warcraft, to form a new studio called Bonfire. "Leaving this team and this company was the hardest non-life-threatening decision I've ever had to make," Mascara said. "I felt that I wanted to take a chance and try to do something totally different." At least he'd left Blizzard with something great. Diablo 3 was one of the best-selling video games in history, having sold 30 million copies as of August 2015. It also proved a point that would influence numerous game developers in the years to come, including but not limited to the makers of The Division and Destiny, whom we'll meet in Chapter 8. Every game can be fixed. Often the developers of a video game hit their stride toward the end of a project, when they learn what their game really feels like to play. For Diablo 3 and games like it, launching was just the beginning of the development process. "Even with a game that has a really strong vision, a really strong identity like Diablo," said Mascara, "I think one of the challenges is that at the beginning of a project, before a game comes out, everybody has a slightly different version of the game in their head. One of the hardest things to do is get it out, but once it's out, there's less discussion about that because you can now see what it is. Game development's really hard, but it's a different type of hard before it's released. It's more existential before it's released." Diablo 3 was proof that, even for one of the most accomplished and talented game studios in the world, with near limitless resources to make a game, years can pass before that game properly coalesces. That even for the third game in a franchise, there are still an impossible number of variables that can throw everyone off. That even a game that launches with crippling issues can, with enough time, commitment, and money, turn into something great. In 2012, when Error 37 spread across the internet, gamers had thought Diablo 3 was doomed. And then it wasn't. Chapter 5. Halo Wars. In the summer of 2004, Ensemble Studios' management team flew to Chicago for an off-site retreat that felt unusually somber. They were having what some would call an identity crisis. Ensemble had spent years working on prototypes for video games that just weren't making any of them happy, and they needed to get away for a few days and talk things through. We said we should be doing what we're passionate about, said Chris Rippey, an ensemble producer who was at the retreat. Get back on track. The question was, what would that look like? Ensemble, based in Dallas, Texas, had been making the same type of video game for nearly 10 years. They'd built their reputation on Age of Empires, a cerebral game series in which you'd start off with a handful of villagers and gradually build an entire civilization. Like Blizzard's Warcraft and Westwood's Command and Conquer, Age of Empires was a real-time strategy game, or RTS, in which the action unfolded without turns or pauses. You'd progress through different technological eras, Stone Age, Bronze Age, as you harvested resources, constructed buildings, and trained armies to conquer your opponents. To finish the first Age of Empires, Ensemble staff went through what Dave Pottinger, a lead designer, described as a terrible death march which could never be repeated today, working 100-hour weeks for nearly a year. When it finally came out in 1997, Age of Empires was an immediate hit, selling millions for Ensemble and its publisher Microsoft. This was followed by a glut of profitable Age sequels, expansions, and spin-offs, eventually leading Microsoft to buy Ensemble. By 2004, the studio was working on yet another game in the series, Age of Empires 3, which was due to come out at the end of 2005. What had always been unorthodox about Ensemble, and what ensured that people rarely left the studio, was that they saw themselves as a family. Since Ensemble's founding in 1995, the company had been made up mostly of young, single men who spent nights and weekends together. On any given Saturday night, a good chunk of the team was at someone's apartment, wrote Ian Fisher, a lead designer, in a magazine retrospective. Ian Fisher, blast from the past. Ensemble figures out how to go from empires to kings. GameSauce Spring 2010. www.gamesauce.biz/2010/09/05/ensemble-figures-out-how-2-go-from-empires-2-kings. Friday after work, there'd be a dozen people in the playtest area playing Quake, then Quake 2, then Half-Life, until 3 a.m. If you didn't actually share an apartment with the guy you sat next to, you were probably going to be having a beer at his place later that night. Even through the early 2000s, as Ensemble's co-founders grew up and started real families, they shared what they saw as an uncommon amount of chemistry. Every prospective employee had to go through a rigorous interview process that, for a while, included meetings with all 20-something people at the studio. If just one person said no, the prospective employee was out. It was really like a family, said Rich Geldreich, a graphics engineer. It was a combination family slash a little bit of a frat house. During that summer of 2004, with Age of Empires 3 in the works, many of Ensemble's veterans grumbled that they were sick of making age games. Some were tired of RTS games in general. They'd tried several times to get a second development team off the ground, one that would experiment with other genres, but that team always seemed to fail. Ensemble would fall into the same pattern every time. The second team would play around with prototypes and early concepts for a while, then the main Age team would invariably run into some sort of catastrophe, such as when they had to redo Age of Empires 2's entire design after a year because it wasn't fun to play. Ensemble's management would then ask the second team to put their own project on hold and come help with the latest Age game. Every time this happened, the second project would lose momentum and peter out, like a steam engine that stopped getting coal. The pattern we fell into, starting with Age 2, was that we so overbid and underfinished the games that even though we tried to do other things, we ended up having to pull everybody in just to get the Age game finished, said Dave Pottinger. In previous years, Ensemble's second team had prototyped an RPG, a platformer, and several other experiments, all of which were discarded. Canceling prototypes wasn't an unusual practice for a game studio, but the pattern was becoming rough for Ensemble staff, who wanted to show the world that they could expand beyond Age of Empires. That was why the management team was sitting in Chicago during the summer of 2004, trying to figure out their next move. Chris Rippey, Dave Pottinger, and the rest of Ensemble's managers evaluated their options. They had two projects in development. There was Age of Empires 3, their next flagship game, and then there was a car action game called Wrench that no one was particularly excited about. For 2 days, they sat and debated. Did they really want to keep working on Wrench? Why were they still doing it? Inertia? Tons of other ideas kept resurfacing. What if they made a Diablo clone? What if they built a massively multiplayer online game, MMO? And what if they developed a real-time strategy game for consoles? For decades, the accepted wisdom had been that real-time strategy games would work only on a computer. Because of the genre's speed and complexity, the RTS was best suited to a mouse and keyboard, so a player could zoom around the map with one hand and type in orders on the other. Consoles didn't have mice and keyboards. They had controllers, whose joysticks and limited buttons proved ineffectual for fast-paced multitasking. For as long as RTS games had existed, nobody had been able to solve this problem. Zealots of PC gaming would point to StarCraft 64, 2000, a subpar port of Blizzard's StarCraft that didn't capture the nuances of its PC counterpart, as evidence that an RTS simply couldn't work on a console. Angelo Lawden, a veteran programmer and member of the Ensemble management team, had always believed otherwise. Like most engineers, Lawden relished the act of solving impossible problems, and he thought a console RTS made for one hell of a challenge. Angela was fired up about it, said Chris Rippey. We had some loose ideas on how to make it work. During the meetings in Chicago, both Lawden and Rippey pushed hard for a console RTS, arguing that it was the perfect opportunity for Ensemble. They had talent and experience. Gamers respected them as RTS developers. And their parent company, Microsoft, was months away from launching the much-anticipated Xbox 360, a powerful new machine that could be home to the first great RTS on consoles. This plan would also allow Dave Pottinger and others on the team who were sick of making RTS games to work on other projects. For years, Ensemble CEO Tony Goodman had wanted to make an MMO along the lines of Blizzard's World of Warcraft, which was due to come out a few months later, in November 2004. Nearly everyone at Ensemble was playing the beta. The thought of developing a big multiplayer game was polarizing at the studio, but Goodman and some of the other veterans, like Ian Fisher, had always wanted to make it happen. By the end of the Chicago trip, Ensemble's management had greenlit three new projects. First was the console RTS, which they gave the codename Phoenix. Second was the MMO, codenamed Titan. The third game, codenamed Nova, would be a sci-fi action RPG and Diablo clone led by Pottinger, once he and his team had finished work on Age of Empires 3. If Blizzard could juggle StarCraft, World of Warcraft, and Diablo, the managers thought, why couldn't Ensemble do something comparable? When the management team got back to Dallas, they announced that they were canceling Wrench and starting these other, more exciting projects. On Phoenix, Angelo Lawden would be the lead programmer. Chris Rippey would be the producer. And to figure out what the game would feel like to play, they brought in one of their most experienced developers, a designer named Graham Devine. Devine, a Scottish expatriate with long hair and a high-pitched laugh, had one of the most eclectic resumes in gaming. As a teenager in the 1980s, he'd done programming work for Atari, Lucasfilm Games, and Activision. Before he turned 30, Devine had founded his own company, Trilobite, and designed a smash hit called The Seventh Guest that blended tricky puzzles with cinematic storytelling. After falling out with his Trilobite co-founder and watching the studio collapse, Devine went to id Software to work alongside one of his old friends, the legendary programmer John Carmack. He spent 4 years helping develop games like Quake 3 and Doom 3 before leaving for Ensemble in 2003, where he was put in charge of coding pathing algorithms, the mathematical formulas that told units how to move, for Age of Empires 3. In hindsight, this felt like an odd choice to the management team. Devine had a legendary brain for game design and storytelling. Why did they have him teaching Age of Empires units how to walk around? Recall Devine, Dave Pottinger called me up and said, hey, we're not really using you properly at Ensemble. We'd really like to try to break this RTS on a console thing. How'd you like to head up a team to try to get RTS on a console? Sure, Devine told Pottinger. When would they start? The Phoenix team was now Graham Devine, Angelo Lawden, and Chris Rippey, as well as a few other artists and programmers. It was a small, close-knit group whose members were excited to work on something that wasn't Age of Empires. Our team of misfits, Devine liked to say. It didn't take long before they had a basic concept in place. Phoenix would be a sci-fi game in which humans battled against aliens, sort of like StarCraft. Playing as the humans would feel drastically different from playing as the alien race, which Devine called the Sway. The goal was to evoke War of the Worlds, pitting hulking alien war machines against the scrappy armies of mankind. The ideas were the easy part. Far harder, Devine knew, would be figuring out the controls. Most video games, when they first enter development, already have a set of controller conventions they can follow. You know that if you pick up a first-person shooter, the right trigger is going to fire shots and the left trigger is going to aim. The left joystick will always control the character's movement, while the right joystick rotates the camera. Designers working on big series like Call of Duty or Assassin's Creed might make small tweaks to the core formula, but they don't have to rethink the controls every time they start developing a new game. Phoenix didn't have that luxury. The main reason real-time strategy games had never done well on consoles was that there had never been a great control scheme. Right away, Divine and the team had to start asking fundamental questions that most games would have already solved. How would you move around the screen? Would you control a cursor as you would in Age of Empires and use that to select units and give them actions? Or would you control units directly? Would you be able to select multiple units at once? How would you construct buildings? Answering these questions would be impossible without testing all the possibilities. So Divine and his team spent months experimenting. "We were burning through tons and tons of prototypes," said Colt McCandless, who had been hired as a graphics engineer for Phoenix. "How to move the camera, how that works, moving the camera and grabbing units, how not to make people nauseous in the process. It was a lot of groundbreaking R&D. They cranked through hundreds of different control schemes. They played games like Pikmin and Alien vs. Predator Extinction, both console games with RTS elements, and tried to pinpoint what worked. "We started incorporating all of their ideas and skipping the stuff we didn't care for," said Chris Rippey. "All of these games did something really smart and really cool, and we just kind of put them all together into one package." Every week, usually every day, they'd hold mandatory playtesting sessions, where the small Phoenix team would sit down and play through the prototypes they developed that week. It was a rigorous, focused process that led them to throw out a whole lot of work. "The feedback system at Ensemble was brutal. It was honest, but it forged a good game," said Divine. From there, they came up with a few control schemes that seemed to feel satisfying, like an area select option that would let you take command of a group of units by holding down the A button. Now they just needed corporate approval. Although Microsoft gave Ensemble the freedom to pursue prototypes like Phoenix and the other second team games they'd canceled over the years, those games couldn't move forward until they got an okay from Ensemble's parent company. Until the bosses in Redmond gave the green light to Phoenix, it would remain in purgatory, unable to enter full production or hire new staff. When Xbox executives came down to visit, the Phoenix team showed them their prototypes. Microsoft seemed happy with what they saw, telling Ensemble to keep up the good work. Toward the end of 2005, as the rest of the studio prepared to ship Age of Empires 3, the Phoenix team kept plugging away, buoyed by the fact that they'd finally made a non-Age game that Microsoft cared about. Members of the Age of Empires 3 team, busy working late nights to finish their game, were far less thrilled. This was an interesting period for Ensemble because it was the first second game that Microsoft got excited about, said Dave Pottinger, who was the lead designer on Age of Empires 3. "And unfortunately for us, it was an RTS, because we had tried for so long not to make an RTS. We didn't want to get pigeonholed into just the RTS company. But of course, that's exactly what Microsoft wanted. That's what we were good at, that's why they had bought us, and that's what they wanted us to do." Microsoft hadn't greenlit any of Ensemble's previous prototypes, but its representatives had really liked Phoenix. Executives on the Xbox team, who were laser-focused on beating Sony's PlayStation 3 in the so-called console war, loved the idea of getting one of their flagship studios on the new Xbox 360. What they didn't love was that this was a new IP. In Microsoft's eyes, this sort of brand-new franchise would be hard to market properly. Real-time strategy games were a tough enough sell in the first place, often performing far worse in the market than the first-person shooters Microsoft loved making. Without some sort of established brand attached to Phoenix, Microsoft's executives feared that the game wouldn't move enough copies to justify their investment. For Ensemble, getting a game greenlit meant progressing through a series of meetings with Xbox executives like Phil Spencer and Peter Moore, which is what the Phoenix team had to do. During the first meeting, things went smoothly. But when Graham Devine and his team met with Microsoft for the second greenlight meeting, Microsoft gave them a new mandate. Make it a Halo game. "Halo was incredibly hot at the time," said Peter Moore. "The first two games had sold millions of copies, and Halo 3, coming in 2007, was one of the most anticipated games ever. We felt that Halo was IP that lent itself well to a real-time strategy game, given the way that the universe was constructed. Good guys versus bad guys, all the stuff you needed in an RTS. And I think that probably the data and the evidence lent towards a lower-risk opportunity in Halo than in new IP. This sort of move isn't uncommon in the video game industry, where publishers tend to be conservative and risk-averse, leaning toward established franchises and sequels whenever possible. Even the most ambitious game studios sometimes rejigger their games to incorporate familiar franchises. Yet for Devine and his development team, who had spent nearly a year working on this project, telling them to change it to a more marketable IP was like telling a new mother to go swap her infant for a better-looking one. Over lengthy, heated discussions, Microsoft's executives explained that if Ensemble wanted to make its console RTS, it would have to be based on Halo. End of story. It was basically put as, either you make this Halo, Devine said, or you're all going to get laid off. Devine was shattered. He'd spent months creating and cultivating Phoenix's world and characters, and he thought they were just as important to the game as anything else they'd done. It wasn't just the console RTS, it was his own unique creation. When you're knee-deep in making your own IP, you love it, Devine said. You really do. You love it. It's yours, and it's fantastic. He also realized that substituting Phoenix's lore for Halo characters would have all sorts of logistical consequences. They'd have to scrap most of the work they'd done so far. When you're presented with making Halo, you try to explain it's not just a matter of calling these aliens the Covenant and these humans the UNSC. It's actually a huge change, Devine said. That I don't think came across very loud and clear. I think Microsoft felt that it was just a color change, a graphical change. I don't remember being 100% surprised, said Chris Rippey. I'm sure it was way more painful for Graham, because he put blood, sweat, and tears into that design, and he's a passionate guy, too, so I know it was more painful for him. Heartbroken, Devine considered quitting Ensemble. He sat at his computer and started up Google. What was this whole Halo thing about, anyway? It was huge, sure, but why did people care about it? Were they just into shooting aliens' heads off? Or was there some sort of hidden depth that Devine didn't know about? As he read more and more about Halo lore, from the super-powered hero Master Chief to the complex alien empire known as the Covenant, Devine started to realize it might be the latter. My view of Halo Friday Night was that it was a bunch of purple aliens that moved really fast in front of you, and you shot them, Devine said. My view Monday morning was, boy, they put a lot of thought into this across a lot of years. Maybe there is something more to it than I thought. With that, Devine and crew made their decision. Phoenix would become Halo Wars. Goodbye, Sway. Hello, Master Chief. Except they weren't allowed to use Master Chief. Bungie, the studio behind Halo, didn't want this team of strangers in Texas messing around with their iconic lead character. Bungie and Ensemble were sister studios, but Bungie was the older, more popular sister, the one who got all of Mom and Dad's attention. Age of Empires was big, but compared with Halo, it had the cultural impact of a brunch photo on Instagram. In 2005, Bungie's first-person shooter series was one of the biggest things on the planet. A few days later, the Phoenix leads flew up to Seattle to visit Bungie. First, they met with the studio's top leaders. They sat down with Joe Staten, the longtime writer of Halo, to talk about the lore and story. They geeked out about control schemes with Jamie Griesmer, Halo's design lead. Later, they addressed the rest of Bungie's staff in a conference room. As Chris Rippey and Graham Devine stood in front of the makers of Halo and talked about their exciting new project, they were greeted by nothing but blank stares. We told them that we were going to be making a Halo RTS, and I don't think any of them had any idea or any warning that this meeting was going to happen, said Rippey. And if you know the Bungie guys, they are very protective of their stuff, so I think we shocked them. I wouldn't say it was hostile, but the reception was cold. And it's not their fault. If somebody had come to us and said, hey, we're making this Age of Empires action game, we'd probably have the same reaction if we didn't know what was going on. To mitigate the tension, Devine and Rippey did what they did best. They played video games. Just a few minutes after telling Bungie's staff about Halo Wars, Devine set them all up with an early build of Phoenix to prove that they'd made a console RTS that felt good to play. By the time Bungie had processed a little of the shock, they were already in front of the game playing it, said Rippey. That helped a lot. It also helped that Devine was eager to absorb as much Halo lore as humanly possible. Everything Joe Staten said, Devine gobbled up, no matter how esoteric or granular it got. By the end of the visit, Devine wanted to be able to explain in detail the difference between a Sanshiyum and a Sangili. The Sanshiyum, of course, are the prophetic leaders of the Covenant, while the Sangili are a race of Saurian warriors. When the Halo Wars team landed back in Dallas, they scrapped just about everything they'd done. They kept the control scheme and the user interface, but all the other ideas they'd put into the Phoenix project would be useless for a Halo game. The team began drawing up new design ideas, story beats, and concept art for Halo Wars, knowing that they were essentially starting from scratch. Because Bungie maintained ownership over all things Halo, Ensemble would have to get Bungie's approval on even the most basic story ideas, which could be a bureaucratic process. Ensemble decided that they wanted the game to revolve around a group of United States Space Command, UNSC, soldiers on a ship called the Spirit of Fire, and that the bulk of combat would take place on the planet Arcadia, which the team had invented just for Halo Wars. All these decisions had to go through Bungie. Recognizing that it might help to be charming, Graham Devine designed a fictional travel pamphlet for Arcadia and showed it to Joe Staten, who was responsible for the series lore at Bungie. I said, "I'm adding a new planet. Please, can I add this? Here's a travel brochure for it," Devine said. Staten was amused by Devine's quirky pitches, and in the coming months, Devine would fly up to Seattle every few weeks to collaborate with Bungie on Halo Wars' story. "I think in the beginning they were really worried," said Devine. "But after a while, they started to really trust me." Yet the Halo Wars team always felt like they were a couple of steps behind. It was difficult to tell a story in the Halo universe when the Halo universe existed mostly in the heads of a bunch of people who lived 2,000 miles away. And besides, Bungie had its own project to deal with, the secretive Halo 3. "We ran into problems of what they were willing to show us and tell us on Halo 3, which made things difficult," said Chris Rippey. "They were looking after their story and what they were doing. They were being pretty protective, so that led to some gaps in our knowledge that we would have to work around." The truth was, a large chunk of Bungie's leadership was never really happy about Halo Wars, according to several people who used to work at both companies. Bungie tolerated Ensemble's questions as cordially as they could. They got a kick out of the whimsical Graham Devine, and Joe Staten was always classy. But in private, Bungie staffers would gripe that they didn't want another studio touching Halo. When Ensemble sent over questions or asked for permission to use certain parts of the lore, Bungie would sometimes stonewall them. In a 2012 interview with the website GamesIndustry.biz, Ensemble's boss, Tony Goodman, went public about their strained relationship. "Bungie was kind of sore about the idea," he told the site. What they called it was the "whoring out of our franchise" or something. Tension between the two studios only exacerbated Ensemble's other problems. Development on Halo Wars was not going smoothly, and by some estimates, the switch to Halo had set the team's progress back months. They were happy with their control scheme. Designers and Ensemble were convinced they'd finally cracked the console RTS code, but conceptualizing and building the world of Halo Wars took far more time than they thought it would. By the middle of 2006, Microsoft had officially greenlit Halo Wars, which meant that Ensemble's management could staff up the project and start producing the art and code they'd need to get it out the door. Now they'd have to confront the problem that had popped up a few months earlier. Outside of Graham Devine, Chris Rippey and Angelo Lawden and the rest of their small team, nobody else at Ensemble really wanted to work on Halo Wars. After a decade of nothing but Age of Empires and its spin-offs, the studio's veterans were sick of RTS games. Given the choice, many of them had flocked to the nascent MMO project in hopes of channeling their World of Warcraft obsessions into a big hit of their own. Others had moved to Dave Pottinger's sci-fi Diablo Nova. Nobody in Ensemble could agree on what to do next, so they all just did different things. Employees would joke that their studio's name had become an ironic punchline. These days, they didn't feel like much of a family at all. Theoretically, most of their resources should have been funneled into Halo Wars, because their parents at Microsoft hadn't greenlit any of the other prototypes, but the studio had become fractured and cliquish. The Age of Empires 3 team didn't want to move to Halo Wars, and even as the Halo Wars team needed to staff up, some of them didn't want the Age guys on their turf either. "We were fine with it," said Colt McCandless, the Halo Wars engineer. "It was a lot of politics internal to Ensemble. We were like, fine, you guys move there and leave us alone." The Halo Wars team, which mostly consisted of younger, less experienced Ensemble staff, saw the veterans as arrogant and difficult to work with. "When they made a decision, they would put the hammer down," said McCandless. "There wasn't a discussion. There wasn't an evaluation. It was just like, no, we're doing it this way. If you don't like it, get out." Elsewhere at Ensemble, there was a perception that Halo Wars was just something they had to do to please Microsoft, like when a Hollywood actor shoots a superhero movie so he has the leverage to film his passion project about climate change. Most of Ensemble's veterans wanted to make other games. At one point, the studio's leadership decided that the big MMO wouldn't take place in a brand new sci-fi world, as had been originally planned. During an all-hands meeting, Ensemble's management announced that actually, they were going to make it a Halo MMO. The designer, Ian Fisher, got on stage and said, "We've chosen an IP, and it's going to be Halo," said Graham Devine. What raised some eyebrows, and what portended bad news for Ensemble, was that they hadn't gotten official approval from Microsoft to make this decision. We realized that Microsoft wouldn't plunk that kind of money down on an unproven IP, said Dave Pottinger. The idea to use the Halo IP was created as a way to get the game made. So, yeah, we didn't exactly ask permission, though they knew. We knew it was going to be a risky choice. From the outside, this all might have seemed insane. Fewer than 100 people worked at Ensemble, yet the studio was simultaneously trying to develop 3 different games, including an MMO, which itself would require a staff in the dozens. World of Warcraft, which set the bar that Ensemble aspired to reach, had a team of 50 to 60 when it launched in 2004, according to a Blizzard spokesperson. The studio couldn't expand without getting approval from Microsoft, and Microsoft seemed to have no interest in greenlighting any of Ensemble's other prototypes, including the Halo MMO. But Ensemble kept working on all 3 games nonetheless. At one point we had a sci-fi RTS on a console, we had a sci-fi MMO, and we had a sci-fi Diablo, all 3 of which were different, said Dave Pottinger. In the most negative view, it was a testament to how much we weren't getting along at that point. As a result, the Halo Wars team remained understaffed. For the longest time, said Rich Geldreich, I would wonder why we only had roughly 25-ish people total on the project when it's our next big major game and there were all these prototypes going on. What Halo Wars really needed was more programmers, especially ones who knew how to handle the trickier aspects of RTS development, like simulating artificial intelligence. In a real-time strategy game, the computer must make thousands of tiny decisions every second, quietly calculating when to construct buildings and move phalanxes of units around the map. For inexperienced programmers, this was a difficult task to handle. Imagine you've got a game world consisting of hundreds of entities, and they all have to pathfind and make decisions in real-time, or seemingly in real-time, said Geldreich. There's AI involved with that. When you give them commands, they're really high-level commands like go here or attack here or stop or something. They have to figure out how to pathfind from A to B, and that can be very complex. Imagine if, as a unit is pathfinding from A to B, a building blows up, or a new route is created because a bunch of trees are cut down. It's a very dynamic problem. Add online multiplayer to the equation, where a laggy connection could desync 2 computers and throw all the simulations off, and you've got all sorts of potential for a broken video game. It didn't help that, instead of using the technology they developed for the Age games, the Halo Wars team had started from scratch with a brand new engine that could take advantage of the Xbox 360's unique computing power. Pathfinding was always a difficult problem in an RTS, but we had invested probably close to 20 man-years in pathing at that point, said Dave Pottinger. The Halo Wars team threw it all away and started over. Despite these hiccups, Microsoft was gung-ho about Ensemble's game. On September 27, 2006, the publisher revealed Halo Wars to the world, showcasing the game with an intense CGI trailer that depicted a war between the human Spartans and their alien opponents. At one point, Ensemble had scheduled the game to be finished by the end of 2007, and perhaps that's what Microsoft was expecting then, though scrutiny of the studio might have made it clear that wasn't going to happen. Graham Devine and his team of misfits were enjoying themselves, but the Halo Wars team was short-handed and too far behind in key areas. One day, frustrated that the art team wasn't properly capturing the Halo aesthetic, Rich Geldreich printed out 400 full-color screenshots from Halo games to hang on the walls. I plastered them everywhere in the studio, he said. In the bathrooms, in the kitchen, the hallways, the meeting rooms, because I was pissed off that this game didn't look like a Halo game. Other teams weren't faring much better. After nearly a year's worth of work, Dave Pottinger's Diablo prototype Nova got canceled. Microsoft chose to instead greenlight a promising action RPG from a different studio called Too Human. This may have been the wrong call. Too Human, released by the developer Silicon Knights in 2008, was poorly received by fans and critics. In 2012, following a long legal battle, a jury ruled that Silicon Knights had breached its licensing agreement with the maker of the Unreal Engine, Epic Games, while working on games like Too Human. In addition to paying hefty damages, Silicon Knights had to recall unsold copies of Too Human and even pull the game from the Xbox 360's digital store. For a few months, Pottinger and a small team worked on another prototype, a spy Zelda game called Agent, but he couldn't get the headcount he needed to finish it, and soon enough, he'd moved to Halo Wars. Pottinger's team split up. Many of the artists went to the MMO, while the programmers joined him on Halo Wars, which desperately needed the coding help. In early 2007, Graham Devine and his crew started working on a Halo Wars demo for E3, where they hoped to quash fan skepticism that Halo would never work as a real-time strategy game. By the time the show came around, they'd created a slick 10-minute video, narrated by Divine, that demonstrated a series of battles between UNSC Marines and the nasty alien Covenant. In the demo, the player built two Warthogs, Halo's iconic armored pickup trucks, and had them leap over a crevasse near his base. Warthogs can gain strategic control of areas of the map that other vehicles can't get to, Divine explained in the video. Fans were hyped, which energized the developers at Ensemble. "That was a really sexy demo, and we came away from E3 that year really excited about the game," said Dave Pottinger.
The reception was good. Graham was the perfect showman and said all the right things about loving the IP.
And he really did love the IP. We got people excited that somebody who was good at making RTSs and cared about Halo was going to go make the perfect marriage between the two. But as work on the project continued, it remained clear that Halo Wars was in trouble. In the months following E3 2007, two major problems emerged. One was that the Halo Wars team remained understaffed. Many of Ensemble's veterans were still working on the Halo MMO, which still hadn't been greenlit but was taking up a great deal of the studio's resources. The second problem was that the design was constantly changing. As a result of Ensemble's various prototype cancellations and internal politics, there were several experienced lead designers on the Halo Wars team by the end of 2007, including both Graham Devine and Dave Pottinger. Devine, who had been leading design since the Phoenix days back in 2005, had a specific vision in mind for the game, while Pottinger, the senior age designer who had just joined the project a few months earlier, had other ideas in mind. But an orchestra needs only one conductor, and the Halo Wars team spent a great deal of time getting into fights. "Not yelling fights, but loud fights," Devine said. "It's funny, it's always around game things. Should the economy be cheaper or should the economy be more expensive? Should bases be freestanding or bases all be connected together? It's all good stuff, it's not, oh my gosh, your t-shirt is terrible. It's all just awesome stuff that makes a game much better. But at the time, it's highly stressful." One of the biggest fights centered on what Devine called the Rule of Eight, a guideline that the Halo Wars team had been following since back in the Phoenix days. What that meant was that the player could select only 8 units at once to ensure that the gameplay didn't feel too clunky and complicated on a controller. Some of the designers began to question this rule, arguing that it was making Halo Wars too simple. Devine pushed back. "When you play test every day, you get very good at the controls," Devine said, "and you forget that you had to learn them at one point. And so all of a sudden you think, well, 10 of these would be perfectly easy, 16 even." It's a common dilemma in game development. When you're working on the same game for years, you'll inevitably get bored. It's tempting to make changes just for the sake of making changes, to spice things up because you're sick of using the same simple control scheme when you get into work every day. For Halo Wars, that became a constant point of tension. Devine and his team had intentionally made this game simpler than its RTS counterparts on the PC because the console controls would be so unfamiliar to people. And now some people were trying to make it more complicated? "We were trying to avoid layers of thinking," said Chris Rippey. "One of the biggest problems with long game development is when you playtest the game for too long, you invent problems and you add layers to the game that don't need to be added." Although they had impressed fans with that Devine-narrated demo at E3 2007, the Halo Wars team was in a sad state. They'd scripted the demo entirely by hand, with code that wouldn't work in the final game. Sure, the graphics were running in real time, but the artificial intelligence wasn't properly hooked up, and playing an actual match of Halo Wars wasn't nearly as satisfying as the demo made it look. In Dave Pottinger's eyes, Halo Wars needed to go in a totally new direction. "We didn't have a game that was fun," said Pottinger. "It didn't work. The E3 demo was a pretty kick-ass demo, but not something that was representative of the gameplay. It was just entirely built for E3. In the months that followed, the Halo Wars team continued to argue over the game's basic features. Were the units on the screen too small? Why was base building so complicated? Should they have control groups that would allow players to assign hotkeys to different squads of units, as in StarCraft and other RTS games? After all the squabbling, something had to give. That something turned out to be Graham Devine. "When lead designers are fighting, it's not good," Devine said. "So we had one meeting where I said, 'Dave, you take the lead design position. I'm having a lot of fun on the story, I'm just going to stick to the story.'" Devine remained the face of the game, showing it off at Microsoft marketing meetings and press events. And Dave Pottinger, who for years had resisted working on another RTS game, became the lead designer of Halo Wars. Right away, Pottinger made big changes to the core mechanics of Halo Wars. "We basically threw the design out and started over," Pottinger said.
He altered almost all the units, including the leaping warthogs they'd shown at E3, which weren't quite working out. Warthogs would remain in Halo Wars, but they would no longer have the ability to jump gaps. He ditched the sprawling base-building system, replacing it with prefabricated bases that each held a finite number of slots. He overhauled the resource system, reducing the amount of time players would have to spend managing their economy. And he added a select-all button, which the team had resisted for a long time. With Halo Wars scheduled for release in just a few months, Pot and